So what are we going to be sewing when this is all done?
Quilts. Quilts, really? Describing my experience of the last, you know, 5 months. That's my intent.
Okay. Yeah. We'll make a nice tree of life pattern, which will actually, you know, it'll mirror our passion nicely.
Everybody can contribute a little square. It'd be lovely. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. You know, we'll share stories.
We've got all the thread and materials here, so yeah. You just have to come.
Lots of needles, lots of space. I love that in an audio medium, people have no idea
None
why this is funny to us. Welcome to wherever you are. My name is Ryan McNeil, Toronto, Canada. You are listening to episode 323 of the Matinee Cast. It's the movie-loving podcast of thematinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. You know, momentum is a funny thing. It can seem like a difficult force to get on your side with feelings of great resistance and friction. Maybe you're trying to develop a habit, learn a new skill, or publish a podcast. Getting the wind at your back can often take some real effort. So too can keeping that tailwind on your side. Once you keep that groove, once you establish that rhythm, it can be an ask to keep it working for you. Why do I bring this up? Well, because in case I haven't mentioned it before, spring can be a tough time to host a movie podcast. Release schedules are all over the place, and if you don't want to talk about Dune, it can be tricky to schedule a show. But we want to keep momentum. We want to keep the conversation going, so we dig a little deeper, we reach back a little further, we work a little quicker, and hold fast to momentum. And on that note, we have a guest today who's been nothing but a source of momentum all the way back to the very, very beginnings of this show. A clever gent, a good friend, often wrong, but never ashamed to admit it. Bob Turnbull is here. How you doing?
More right than wrong, I would like to think, but clever. I like that. I'll take that.
You like how I got that right at the end there?
Yeah. You twisted the tables on me. You gave me the happiness and the sadness, which, by the way, we're going to come back to shortly with this movie.
Oh, yes. We're working quickly today. We are going to talk about a film. We're going to get the heck out and move on to the next one. The next one that we will talk about in 2 weeks, I am really excited about. And then something actually really exciting is going to happen after that. So it's high times and good times here in 24 for the Matinee Cast. And we want, as I said, to hold on to the momentum. And speaking of which, let's keep it going and go into the new slang for episode 323, where we are going to talk about Perfect Days.
There is a house in New Orleans. They call the rising sun.
Perfect Days is directed by Wim Wenders. It's written by Wenders along with Takuma Taka. It stars Koji Yakusho, Tokio Imoto, Arisa Nakano, and Ai Yamada. Perfect Days takes us to Tokyo and introduces us to Hirayama, that's Yakusho, a gent who cleans public toilets around the city. His days are pretty simple. Wake up, wash up, water the plants, go to work, eat lunch, work some more, grab some dinner, watch some baseball, come home, read, go to sleep. Repeat. That's about the size of it. Sundays are a little different. A few times a week he goes to the bathhouse, but really and truly, Hirayama is a creature of habit. You can set your watch by his comings and goings. There are a few curves that enter the fray. His co-worker, Takashi, is lovesick and broke and hits up Hirayama for money. The object of Takashi's affection, Keiko, drops in on their workday and takes a shining to Hirayama's cassette collection, and even his niece Nico pays her uncle an unexpected visit. From moment to moment, though, potentially perfect days. Seems strange to say it, but they are, and we get to witness every single one. Recently, I came across a quote by Keith Haring that stated that the rise of technology has necessitated a return to ritual. Haring was referring to the way that computers and capitalism were pulling the world we're talking about here is the world of the 1980s, firmly into the realm of rational thought, and that there needed to be a place for irrational thought. What's interesting about that statement is that it can be recontextualized into the times that we live in now, some 40 years after Haring's day, that in this age that is increasingly virtual, that there is something to be said for a return to Ritual. So pop quiz, hotshot. Does Perfect Days have something to say about that? With all the routine, habit, and ritual of this film, is there some sort of message mixed in with it all? And if so, what?
I'd say yes, but it's not as simple as just the be happy with small things or routine or simplify your life. I think its grander message, and by the way, this is a wonderful, wonderful film. Its grander message, I think, has to do about embracing the joys and the sadness of life and combining them all together into one big stew. Something I think, I'm trying to remember what the Japanese word is komorbi, I think, and it's even referred to at the end of the film, which is the combination of lights and shadows cast via leaves, and really they're moments in time. They never happen again, and it's these wonderful patterns and so forth, and it's embracing that. You can't really capture it, but what do you do with that? Well, maybe you find another one to follow that. So I think the film grows from you can have a pleasant life of routine into something grander, like embrace all these different aspects of life. And I think that's what I found so wonderful about it. If it was just about routine, it would still be great because of all the things that we're going to talk about, primarily Koji Yakusho. But I think the way I interpret it, I'm sure there's different ways of seeing it. I'd love to hear what you think too. It just added so much more into the film, especially after the second viewing. I just adored it.
I think it's funny because, you know, we were making jokes before we hit record tonight and talking about having bigger spaces to live in and how that necessitates more things. While it provides more space, you know, the old joke of look at all the space for activities. It also seems to encourage one to amass more stuff. And this is a film about a man who lives very, very simply. Like, his luxuries are a small amount of books, a small amount of cassette tapes, and a small little cluster of plants. Besides that, everything else is very, very simple, humble, not poor. Like, he's not somebody I would say is, you know, while this movie does have something to say about class, he's not what I'd call somebody who's broke. He's just a guy who just lives simply, acquires, you know, simply as well, and that is good for him. I think what that left me with, that I feel ties back to what Herring was saying, is if you live simply, sometimes simple joys will find you, you know, and simple joys can be anything from, you know, noticing the way the light hits the trees and the shadows and those kinds of things, or, you know, finding places that will still sell you books for a dollar, because all kinds of places will part with things for a very little amount of money. Or sometimes simple joy is just sitting with your thoughts and seeing what comes to you. And in this movie, while there is certain sadness, yes, there is a lot of joy in this movie, and it just seems to find its way to Hirayama because he's open to it, because he is basically ready to accept any little delight, any little treasure that life happens to send him, and not in a very twee Wes Anderson Amelie kind of way, just in the way that he is happy to sit with his thoughts. And because he's happy to sit with his thoughts, sometimes his thoughts are interrupted by, you know, a note that happens to be left in a crack in the wall, those kinds of things. His thoughts happen to be interrupted by another like stranger in the same space. That's where I thought that this went. You've already seen this film twice, so clearly I know you must appreciate it.
Very much so. We'll talk about Wim Wenders in a bit, I guess. I don't have a lot of experience in Wender films. I mean, the two big ones, Paris, Texas, Wings of Desire, and two of his docs, Pina and blanking on it.
We call it the Venderverse?
Buena Vista Social Club. I haven't seen King of the Road and some of his older ones. Regardless, I love the, I guess it's slowness of this film, but it's probably the wrong word to use, but just the more thoughtful approach to watching him, seeing the little stumbles he has, the little things that happen to him, the way he addresses them. You know, the first half hour of this movie is his, is that first day and learning of his routine. And I was fascinated by it. I wasn't bored for a second. It's a stripped down life, very much so. So much so that he doesn't talk much at all, even to his coworker. Actually, I think at one point says to his girlfriend, it's kind of like, yeah, I've been working with him for, you know, this many years, 10 out of 10. I don't really know what his voice sounds like, though, because he just doesn't, he won't answer his phone. He doesn't say hello. He just puts it to his ear. But that seems to work for him. It's like you said, he's finding joy elsewhere, whether it's specifically due to pulling away from things in his past, and we're not actually sure what his past is. We get a few hints towards it near the end of the movie. Or if that's a very specific decision that he's kind of made, hard to say. I think he can have different interpretations here, but I love how, you know, the dream sequences that break up each day when he goes off to bed, basically it flips to black and white, and you get this sort of abstract version, if not of his day, of the images going through his mind. It's almost kind of like he's processing these things, and he's finding other little tidbits that he's going to keep, or that he's, you know, going to like either address or maybe push off to the side. And I think that's where this movie goes, is that it kind of allows him, especially in that final absolutely wondrous scene of just his face for a minute or two, how he's trying to address them all kind of at once. And I think it's a wonderful kind of end point for his character. I kind of jumped to the end of the movie a little bit quick, but it sort of encapsulates sort of my view of this movie.
What I love about it is several things. I mean, we can talk about the end of the movie because it's not the kind of movie you can spoil. It's not the kind of movie where we are building up to one great big twist, you know, in the last 30 minutes. Much as I did think there may be some sort of a twist coming, I did love the way this film embraces life and encourages us to take life as it comes to us. I thought it was really masterful that this film is not repetitious. I was going to ask later on if this movie is too repetitive, because we go through basically two types of day for him. We go through his work day and one of his weekend days over and over and over and over. And we can, you know, we can spot the little differences in them. By and large, his days are very similar from day to day. It's just kind of usually there's like usually one little interruption that's a little bit different. And I say this as a creature of habit. This is the funny thing, is my coffee shop used to be able to set the clock by the time I walked in the door. And even the one that I go to now, they're like, hey, are you feeling okay? You're not walking in at 7:05 the way you used to.
You embrace it and it works for you. And I think he's
The thing is that that could be very dry. Like, you know, it's interesting to me, but I don't think that that's necessarily going to be interesting to the whole wide world. And yet the way Wenders approaches this, he finds just the constant beauty to keep on flowing from moment to moment, even though you've gone through some of these moments before, and the moments that you haven't, you kind of know how they're going to go. After the first 15 or 20 minutes, you really get an idea of what you're in for. And yet it's never slow, it's never boring, and it really has this incredible subtle beauty throughout.
Yeah, it's some of the small details, it's the small joys, it's the small changes in life, it's whether you embrace it and go with it or not. And yeah, I was never once bored in this movie whatsoever. And it's 2 hours?
Lou Reed is singing at the 2 hour mark.
it moves quickly, which is a weird thing to say, even though, you know, I mentioned his first day is half an hour and he barely speaks, it feels like it moves quickly because they give you all these little slices and pieces of his life while also giving a really interesting view of Tokyo, at least in his area. So another thing I think that's kind of relevant here is perspective. And I was thinking about that because I rewatched Wings of Desire again as well, and the different kind of perspectives from high up, from low down. Like anywhere he goes in the city, he can see that tower. His perspective on himself, his perspective on other people's perspective and view of him. I think it all sort of rolls into this really interesting kind of view of life for him and life in that kind of area. You can almost sort of map out, you know, his bike rides over the bridge, where he's walking, his driving, and all those high shots of, you know, his little van going through the spaghetti kind of network to get to the different kind of toilets, public toilets that he's cleaning. I think it's just a wonderful way to give you that sense of place as well.
What I love about it is there is very much a sense of place. There is a gravity to how he moves around and where he is in the grand scheme of things. He's not in the kind of Tokyo that gets played up in a lot of movies. You know, like his Tokyo is not the same as you know, Kurosawa's Tokyo or the same as Ozu's Tokyo. It's a very specific work-a-day corner of Tokyo for everybody. Like every space that he moves through, whether it's the photography shop or the restaurant or the bathhouse or whatever, it's all like very, very blue-collar work-a-day people, which I think is part of why his niece and his sister crashing into that seems so jarring in the later going of this film. It's because you can tell they are not from this corner of the city. Like, they are very much out of their element, like right down to his sister's car.
Like, you know, no doubt about that. So she's, you know, it's chauffeur driven as well. But I'm glad you brought that up, because both the niece and the mother, again, show two different perspectives. So the niece, oh, yeah, you know, after she gets there, basically asks him, you know, do you clean toilets? Or, you know, I think actually when she goes to join him for work, she watches him while he's standing outside of a stall waiting for somebody to finish. And you can tell she's kind of like, ah. Oh. But things change with her very, very quickly, because she realizes he's not embarrassed by this. This is a job. He's good at it. He gets gratification from it. His sister, though, when she shows up, she's like, are you still cleaning toilets? You know, in that kind of like, oh. Oh, you're stuck with that. And she doesn't, and she likely won't ever change her point of view on that. So I love the fact that the younger niece is somebody that he appreciates right away, that she kind of gets it, or she wants to get it. She's curious. She's curious about his cassettes. She's curious about his work. She's curious about his books. Starts reading one of the Patricia Highsmith books.
Yeah.
And, you know, relates to one of the characters. So I love the fact that he realizes that pretty immediately. He was like, yeah, I like the cut of your jib.
Youth seems more malleable to the nobility or the romanticism of the working class, right? Or to somebody who lives a simpler life. Usually when somebody gets older, us, you know, there's a little more skepticism that creeps in, a little more experience that creeps in, and, you know, maybe we come with our own baggage and we saddle other people with that. So, you know, even though I'm sure his sister cares about him, even though we get the deep impression that they are very much estranged, it's harder for her because she's an adult, she has a life, she has responsibility, she has plans for her future, and she's looking at, you know, her family, her sibling, who does not live that way, and it just does not compute, you know, because she is subscribing to, this is the way you live, this is the way you plan for your future, this is the way you take care of your loved ones, and if you're not doing that, I don't know how to talk to you.
Yeah, she's very regimented in that view. Yeah, you can tell. And, you know, nope, there's no option, Nico, for you to stay another night. But she's taken off guard, I think, when he hugs her at the end. And there's that sort of brief moment of like, well, maybe she might be open to at least, you know, kind of accepting the fact that he could be happy.
Perhaps.
That's probably a long road, but there's at least an entry point there.
Yeah. Yakusho in the center of this movie. I mean, there's not a damn thing that happens in the movie without Yakusho. Yakusho won Best Actor at Cannes. You know, legendary Japanese actor, star of Tampopo. It's a very, very subtle performance. It's not what I'd call like coiled or opaque or anything. Like, it's very simple. It's very warm. It's a very, very loving performance, both for the kinds of joys in life that we're talking about, good food, plants, books, music, certainly. And, you know, caring about the job that you do, caring about the people who you interact with, whether you know them or not, you know, like there's just times that I notice, when he's sharing the same space, he comes back often to this tea garden to eat his modest little sandwich and have his lunch and look at how the light is coming through the trees. And when he's there, he'll often see there's a young woman who sits on the bench on the other side of the tea garden. And he just gives her a nod, you know, like, hi, how are you? He's not going to say anything. He's not going to encroach upon her space and her quiet and her happiness. But he's just like, he acknowledges that she is also there enjoying the same space. How you doing? You know, like things like that. He does them with just a real grace that makes it all seem so effortless. Effortless.
Just like your vocabulary.
Just like my diction, yes.
He's been one of my favorite actors for 10, 15 years. I think ever since ever since the late 90s in the early 2000s, when I started catching up with some of the late 90s Japanese J-horror films like Cure or Chiral Pulse by Kiyoshi Kurosawa. He's in a Shohei Imamura film called Warm Water Under a Red Bridge, and he's fantastic in that. He's fantastic in everything. And he's particularly good in this. You know how people talk about, oh, I can listen to that person read the telephone book? I could watch him read the telephone book with no volume and just watch him read it. And it'd be fine. It'd be great. Because there's so many scenes where he's not speaking here, and he's just... Riveting's the wrong word, but he's just such a wonderful, real performance. And going back to that last scene, a 1-2 minute shot of him laughing, happy, crying, being very kind of sad, all while he's driving. Just everything sort of coming to the fore, and it feels so absolutely real. He's wonderful.
He really is. And what I love about him is, you got to watch him. Like he forces you to pay attention because he's so subtle in his inflections, you know, both for better and for worse. Like I'm thinking as for instance, there's a moment late when he goes to his sushi restaurant and he opens the door and it's not ready for supper. Like he's running a little early and it's not quite ready for service. The woman who runs it is inside and she's caught in a bit of an awkward position. And you see that all just kind of wash over him quick and back out he goes, you know, or later on, not like in that same evening, the other person who was in that same situation happens to find him and he tries to explain what's going on, tries to bring him into this world that has nothing to do with him. Nothing about Hirayama makes me think that he really wants to get into anybody's business. You know, I don't think he wants to know what's going on in the stranger's life. I don't think he wants to know how it involves the restaurant owner or how it affects him, because it really doesn't affect him. But in that moment, you're watching this just swirl of emotion on him as he finds himself in this place, and how you contrast that to all of his, you know, just the way he goes about business and the way he just goes about his own time.
He's a very empathetic person, right? I mean, it doesn't show in his communication, and he can communicate very well without words. But, you know, there's that that old man he sees in the park a few times who at first, you know, I thought maybe he's doing Tai Chi, but you know, you get the idea that maybe he's homeless, maybe suffering from dementia. And you can see a look of concern on his face when he can't find him in the park or he sees him downtown. You know, it's not just that simple of like, oh, I'm concerned. But like there's real empathy there for people. He's just, I don't think he knows what to do with that sometimes either. I kind of love all that rolled into this character, this real, true human character that I was more than happy to spend 2 hours with.
It's an economic performance. That's the word I'm looking for. He does so much without needing to overexert. And listen, I love a grand performance as much as the next person. I can't get me enough Daniel Day-Lewis, but or latter day Al Pacino.
Or Nicholas Ray melodramas in the 50s. You know, give me that big.
Yeah, love them. Fantastic. Yeah. You know, May, December, love it. But there is something to be said for economy of acting, economy of performance, economy of direction. And that's what this movie really wants to bring. Now, that said, I got to ask, is it strange that Wenders went to Japan for this story? I mean, Wenders has never been the kind of guy who really stays home. I don't actually entirely know where Wenders is from natively.
Germany, I think. But I think the only thing I really know is like he's... Two things. He's a huge fan of Ozu. He, you know, references him late in the movie.
I get that impression.
Hirayama is the family name from his last movie, Autumn Afternoon, which I still haven't seen, unfortunately. But so he's referencing all that. He had a film called Tokyo Ga, a documentary about visiting the spots in Tokyo that Ozu used in his movies. So obviously I think he's filmed there before. He's familiar with it through Ozu and his films, and he loves it. And I think the reason he signed up with this project is I read a little tidbit of information of these public toilets that that Hirayama cleans. They're really cool looking toilets. Like, there's some really neat things. They're all very different in different parts of Tokyo. And they were built specifically, I think, for the Olympics in 2020. COVID, of course, that sort of changed the nature of how people may have used public restrooms. They didn't quite get the spotlight that the people who built them thought they would. So they went out to some filmmakers and said, can you do a documentary on our creation of these public toilets? And I think vendors went, well, wait a second, I think I can use this in one of my stories. And I think that's what led to this movie. I think that's a great end. I love the fact that he kind of went, hey, I think I can use these with a character that maybe he's been thinking of for a while in another context. Yeah. I don't know, but he put it into this. And
I mean, well, the interesting thing, though, is that he does it without it seeming like appropriation. Which is a really tough needle to thread as a straight white dude.
I think he does a great job in just letting the characters be themselves, lets Tokyo be itself. He's not trying to impose any kind of outside view of what being Japanese is. It's very much a universal story from that point of view, but it just happens to also take place in Japan and relates again to this idea of komorbi, which is a Japanese specific word, but I think is again a universal concept.
The one statement in the movie that I actually latched onto is when he is hanging out with his niece, and she wants to go off and do something really, really special, and he's trying to placate her the same way that any adult will placate their children or their nieces or nephews or their wards. And say, you know, like maybe sometime. And she's like, when is sometime? And he says, well, sometime is sometime. And now is now. And we get into this little sing-songy back and forth of now is now. I did like that idea of now is now, because that really seems to be what Hirayama is all about, is now is now, whether now involves being in the bathhouse and really just, you know, soaking in the tub, or now is watching the baseball game while you eat dinner, or now is looking at the trees in the tea garden and noticing that there's a little prop that you can take home and add to your little collection of plants. This idea of now is now, again, I kind of think goes back to that Keith Haring quote that I was saying at the beginning, where the rise of technology and the rise of being connected virtually is taking away from a real and true now, in that you can't find the space, you can't find the attention to, you know, look at a tree and notice that there's a plant that you could take home.
I love that concept. And what's really interesting is that he's not dissing anything. He's not dissing modern society. He's just saying now is now, and you got to do something with that. You can embrace it, you can try and capture it, you can hold on to it, you can absorb it, you can be open to more, but now is now. It's simple as that. It was really kind of neat when I rewatched Wings of Desire. Early on in the movie, the angel in the movie that wants to become human actually talks about, I want to live in the now. I want to experience black newsprint on my fingers from a newspaper. Really kind of small other joys or bits of sadness or even pain. And he wants to live in the moment. And it's kind of like, hey, I recognize that idea. I think that's, again, a key thing that comes from this movie. And again, really relates to even, that idea of komobi, the light and the dark. They're there, so embrace it, deal with it. It's an instance, and then move on to the next one. And what can you do with that?
The other cool thing about all of that is that while this film is a mild rejection of tech, like, this is a film that really seems to love analog, you know, whether it's film photography or audio cassettes or paper books, it's not a film that really wants to feel better about that. Like, it's not a movie that wants to say, well, you haven't really heard it unless you've heard it on cassette, you know. And listen, I'm even the kind of guy who would probably say that. You know, be like, you have not heard Rush until you've heard them on vinyl. And that's for you.
I was going to say, vinyl will give you a cassette. No, never, not, never want.
Well, I mean, audio. There's a whole movement for that, right? Like, there's a whole movement for people who love to watch movies on video. There's a whole, you know, all of these little tactile interactions, whether it's paper, letters, or film photography, as inconvenient and costly and ephemeral as they are, there's a whole movement towards this thing. I do get it. But the thing is that Takashi is not embracing tactile and embracing retro because he thinks it's cooler or because he, you know, has some sort of affinity that it's more real. So he's not beating everybody else over the head with it. He just enjoys it. It's cheap. It comes to him. He can, you know, he can get an enjoyment from it. That's what I like about it, is that it, like, really and truly, I'm not kidding. If that was me, I would absolutely be a dick about it. I would be the person saying, well, you can read on your tablet, but if you're not flipping pages, are you really reading? That would be me. But yeah,
I recognize that, you know, in you for sure. Yes.
It's not subtle. Takashi is not that person. Takashi, he enjoys them because he does. And if other people enjoy other things, so be it. I do have to ask, does this movie suffer from a lack of stakes?
Well, right off the bat, no, not at all. Not certainly not for me, not in the way I've read the movie, not okay. In my view of
explain, because here's the thing is that, like, again, if somebody watches the first 30 minutes of this movie, if they tapped out, then I could say, all right, you gave it a shot because you saw the day. We're going to go through a bunch of days that are kind of like that. And there's not going to be a day where he gets fired at the end of the day. There's not going to be a day where, you know, his little toilet cleaning van hits the guy who he keeps seeing in the parks. Like, and I was actually kind of waiting for that. I was waiting for, there is going to be some small moment that is going to seem huge in this man's life. And it doesn't come. Now, I'm curious about that because for some people, they may have expected that catalyst to finally ignite. And yet it doesn't. Well,
People will take from movies whatever they want. You know, everybody looks for something different in movies. I want to be surprised by movies. I want good stories, obviously. I want interesting characters. And sure. I think that's probably, you know, if you're talking about, well, why do you like this movie without the stakes? Well, two reasons. One is, I think there are stakes, but I'll get back to that. But the second one is, I find him very interesting. Yes, that first half hour is just his first day, and it is all very, very kind of routine. And it's probably because it's Koji Yakusho, but I'm kind of like, I want to know more about this guy. I want to kind of see his life. I want to understand where this is going. I want to know if he is going to be hit in the parking lot or if it's going to be something else. So I'm all in. I'm all in for that because they created a really interesting and real character. Stakes is probably the wrong word, I guess, but I think there is big stuff in this movie. It goes back to what I initially said at the beginning of how you can try and approach life, right? It's, you know, like the recent Miyazaki movie, which was initially titled, How Do I Live? I think it's gone through a couple of titles before The Boy and the Heron, but it's kind of like, how do you approach life? What's your mindset on this? What are you looking for in life? And that's kind of what he is figuring out through this movie. He thought maybe he figured it out, and then I think comes to a different realization towards the end. I think that's big.
This is something that's on me. It's not the kind of big that I expected. I really did expect something that for, you know, the whole world, you know, to put a point in it, I thought he might get fired or he might find that his bathhouse was closed or he might find that, you know, his plants had all died, you know, something that within the scale of his life was really affecting, would really throw him for quite a loop, but in the grand scale of the whole wide world is not that huge. For instance, I thought it would be something like, you know, he goes to have dinner at that restaurant and he finds that it's closed. There is a scene right before he goes to that restaurant where he is interacting with a gentleman at this like vacant lot in his neighborhood. And the gentleman says to him, do you remember what was here?
There was a line that followed that. The older gentleman that he met said, I guess this is what happens when you get old. The implication there is things change, things go away. Maybe your memory is not so good. There's a bunch of things, right? Because even Hirayama is kind of like, I'm not sure what was here. Like you didn't say that, but his face says that.
I thought it was going to be something a little bit more like that, that his camera place was going to close or the bathhouse was going to close, like something more important to him was going to, you know, not be there. And in the grand scheme of Tokyo, the world, 2024, what have you, it wouldn't be that big a deal. But to him, it would be a real change in his world order. That's what I was expecting.
Yeah, and your expectations were subverted, I guess, or you know, you got something different. And how are you going to deal with that? You're going to embrace it, is what you're going to do, just like he does, right? And,
I see what you did there. I don't like it, but I see what you did.
but also, I mean, there is his niece's visit and his sort of seeing his sister again for, you know, for the first time in X number of years, months. They don't say, because she does say you should go visit dad. He doesn't know much these days. He's not like he used to be. There's some past there for sure. So that's obviously bringing up a whole bunch of things, which, you know, is part of what he's going through at the end of the movie, that sort of happy sadness. So there is a change in him throughout this movie. It's slow. It's not the big earth-shattering kind of a thing. And maybe that his visit from the sister is just one part of all of that stuff that leads up to that last scene. Who knows what the next day is going to be?
I feel like I know what it's going to be.
likely no earth-shaking revelations for much of the rest of his life, but maybe he'll go back and embrace more of his family. Maybe he'll revisit. He'll deal with his past. Don't know. But I like that that's now open for possibility with him. And I don't think it really was at the start of the movie.
Do you think that this movie is out to make some sort of a statement on class?
I don't really want to try and put myself in Vendor's head. I think because of everything else I see in the movie and I get from it, I'm not reading the political or class pieces of it. I think it's kind of implied in there. You know, his sister's got the chauffeur. There's one scene early on where he finds a little boy in a bathroom stall. The boy is calling for his mother, so he takes him by the hand and he's looking throughout the park. And the mother comes running up and, you know, takes the boy away from him and immediately gets like a hand wipe to wash his hand because the boy was touching the hand of Hirayama, who's in his overalls and is obviously, you know, the guy cleaning the toilets. She never once thanks him, never even looks at him, doesn't even address his existence and walks away. So, yeah, it's there. Is it trying to make a statement? Smarter people can weigh in on that. I for me, that's not the major thing that I got from this movie.
To answer my own question, I don't know if it's out to make a statement, but I think that statements are made. That scene that you mentioned is one, you know, I lost count of the amount of times that people just sail right past him and use the bathroom that he's cleaning. And I could never do that. I could never, if something is down for maintenance, if something is down for cleaning, I could never blow right past the people doing the job that, let's be honest, most of us don't want to do and just, you know, take my place, get what I need, use it how I need to use it. And yet these people who blow in and out of this movie, that's exactly what they do. And, you know, like Vendors doesn't belabor the point. He doesn't linger on it. He doesn't linger on Hirayama's reaction. He certainly doesn't, you know, play it up with any kind of music or photography or anything embellishment, but it's there. And I feel like, you know, every single thing that is within the frame of this movie is there deliberately. And I feel like he wanted to make a subtle comment on class, that here are, you know, there are people in this world who are only there to really make it pleasant and, you know, inhabitable for the rest of us. And we don't even want to give them a second thought, you know, or if we do want to give them a second thought, it's, well, don't go near them because, you know, they're poor, they're dirty, they're what have you.
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. And you know, it is there in the movie. For me, I think it helped more fill out Hirayama's character, and that he wasn't perturbed by that. It's kind of like, yeah, whatever. I'm comfortable in my role. I'm comfortable with my life. So I saw it more as directed towards him and his character than making the bigger statement. But you're not wrong. It's there. It's clearly there. Just on the point of the people that use the washrooms that interact with them a little bit, I really like the one woman who goes into one of those opaque doored washrooms, and she's actually
asks him, how does this work?
And without speaking, he just shows her, and she goes in, and she makes it work, and you just hear her giggle.
Yeah.
Because she just loved the moment. She embraced this really small thing and thought, how wonderful is this? And by the way, those are pretty awesome bathrooms.
They are. And I mean, I think that that was a moment. Like they were kind of kindred spirits because, if Hirayama was somewhere else in the world and he had to use the facilities and the facilities had some kooky little thing that he wasn't used to, he would probably find it absolutely delightful.
Absolutely. Yeah, he'd take a picture of it or he'd write it down or something.
On his little Olympus camera. Was there anything about this movie that we didn't bring up that you wanted to dig into?
I think the only last thing is the music. We talked about his love of cassettes. They're mostly 60s and some 70s music that he puts on. Usually kind of in the middle of his drive, it almost appears to me that he wants to be respectful and just be able to play the full song. But each song kind of is relevant to what's happening. Maybe a bit on the nose, but I was kind of fine with that. I mean, there's two Lou Reed songs in there. One obviously is Perfect Day. I think either after or during his day with his niece. But the first one that he plays, Pale Blue Eyes, kind of hits exactly what I was talking about. The line, sometimes I feel so happy, sometimes I feel so sad. It's a pretty simple line, but it's sung right there in the truck early on in the movie, and it's kind of like, thanks for sort of leading me along to what this movie is going to be about. And Patti Smith and her empowerment for the young girl Aya, the Nina Simone song at the end during that final scene, feeling good. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, and he's embracing the crap out of it.
I love in that moment is none of these songs are what I would call a deep cut. Like, we are not looking to assign any new meaning to a hidden gem. We're not digging down to track 9 on the album that everybody usually skips because the ending is a banger. Ask your parents, kids. We're taking hits. We're taking House of the Rising Sun. We're taking Perfect Day. Playing them because they're wonderful songs that will fit the mood. And I love the way that the film plays them diegetically and lets them take over. Whether it's he's reading and he wants some music to break up the silence, he's driving. It's usually when he's driving. But, or when he's got Takashi and Takashi's girlfriend in the van and they're poking through and playing. I really do love the way that the soundtrack does not try to be too clever. And at the same time, it's also not being too obvious. It's not playing Satisfaction and trying to be the, 300th movie to use Satisfaction in an interesting way. It's using songs that are familiar because they would be familiar to this character, but still just keeping them like just deep enough. They're not track 1, but they're not track 9 either, that they all play so delightfully when they come on.
Well, it's like when Nico plays Brown Eyed Girl. That's her selection. Yeah. It's kind of like, that's actually a little bit cheesy, but it hits it spot on, that sort of nostalgia kind of thing, this young
I don't even like Van Morrison these days, but I really liked hearing that song in that moment.
I was about to say almost exactly the same thing. So it fits. In many other movies, as you mentioned, be kind of like, oh, are we playing Brown Eyed Girl because the girl has brown eyes? Okay, that's fine. Or are we playing It's the End of the World as We Know It because it mentions a character that's actually in the movie?
Oh my God. That was the one that, thank you for reminding me. That was the moment where I was like, really? We're doing this? All right. This is complete. If there is an anti-maestro, it is Perfect Days. At the end of every matinee cast, we have a souvenir, something tangible or intangible. If you could take away from this movie and keep, you would. There are a lot of things in this movie, tangible, that we could take away and keep. Bob Turnbull, what are you taking?
One of my favorite scenes in movies this year is when he goes to that restaurant and you hear House of the Rising Sun for the second time. First time is in his van, one of the songs is played. Second time is the woman behind the bar is asked to sing her song, and she sings with somebody accompanying her on the guitar. And it's, I think, live to, the on set. Holy crap, is it good. it's not just that her voice is fantastic, and it is. It's not like chills up your spine because she's hitting every note perfectly, although I think she is. It's just, oh my goodness, it's just so wonderful. And his reaction to it as he closes his eyes, he's almost in this moment of revelry. And it's kind of like, yeah, dude, what an amazing cover of that song. And unfortunately, it's only, I don't know, 30 seconds long or a minute long or whatever. Yeah. Oh, I could ramble about that for a while, but it's just so absolutely beautiful.
I want his tapes. I'm sure this will surprise absolutely nobody. I want his tapes, his cassettes. He has great taste. I love that, you know, analog music that's a little more economic and compact than vinyl, and still comes with you on the go. I want his tapes. He has wonderful music, and I want to just borrow. I don't want to keep them because they mean far more to him than they do to me. But I want to. I would love to borrow his tapes for a few days. We rate on the Matinee Cast here a scale of 1 to 4 stars. Bob Turnbull, Perfect Days. What do you got?
I, as always, I don't like rating things. I don't think I've ever given a perfect score before, but you know, for Perfect Days, sure, give it a 4. I don't see how you make this better in for what I think he was trying to do, for what I got out of it. Performances, everything about this movie is kind of spot on. I can't take a thing away from it, and I wouldn't even try.
I mean, it is a magnificent movie. I'm going 3.5 just because I wanted a little more crisis.
That's you know? On you, as you said. That I is give admittedly, you 3.5 stars, young man.
As well you should. I'm admittedly being hard on it, but at the same time, I am delighted with the time I spent with Perfect Days. You know, I can't wait to go back. I really, really do hope people find this movie and spend some time with it because it's wonderful. It's a wonderful movie just to soak in. You don't need to even really listen. Just watch this man, watch him go through his life, watch how he really embraces it. And you know, don't worry about me and my thoughts, just be with this movie. Let me know what you think about this movie. Ryan at thematinee.ca, Twitter, where I am matinee_CA, or facebook.com/darkmatinee. What do you think of Wim Wenders' Perfect Days? We're going to do a truncated other side just before we head on home. We're not going to do a full section. There's all kinds of movies that one could associate with Perfect Days. Where did your brain go, Mr. Turnbull? What do you think that somebody could couple this movie with if they so chose?
A few spots. One I won't mention because it's come up in a lot of different kind of reviews. I just want to see if you latch onto it as well. But a couple of English language ones that popped out were Happy Go Lucky by Mike Lee. Inside Out, the combination of different kind of emotions and so forth. Emma Lee was another one I thought of, just be looking for the joys, the simple joys in life and trying to share them. Completely different style, of course, but might be a good kind of contrast. But the two I landed with are both Japanese. I'll start with one of my one of my favorite directors, Hirokazu Koreeda, and one of his earlier films, Afterlife.
Back to you.
You did, and thank you very much. It's
right in time for a Criterion edition. So now I guess I just could have kept it.
Yeah, then you would have forced me to buy it. So yeah, damn you for bringing it back. I absolutely adore this film as well. I actually have to thank Roger Ebert, probably Siskel as well. Way back when, I remember hearing them talk about it in one of the reviews, and it was in theaters in Toronto. I think it was at the Canada Square Theater. Young and Eglinton, near where you used to live and where I used to live too. Went to see it and just, wow. There's nothing flashy about this movie. It's at a very similar kind of pace. It's about people who are essentially, not purgatory, but it's kind of a way station. They've passed on, but they haven't gone to heaven or, you know, they haven't taken that next step yet. And they stay in this area and they try and think about what's the best moment of their lives they want to relive over and over again. And the team that works in this place, this middle ground, creates the scenario for them, usually through kind of cheap practical effects, but they create this thing and they play it for the person. They film it and they play it for the person and the person then moves on.
Yeah.
What's really wonderful about it, and I'm stretching a bit to really relate it directly to this movie, but there's so many interviews with people about them trying to figure out the best moment of their lives. Some of them are with real people. Part of this movie is actually kind of like a documentary. They're talking to people. I think there's one old lady in particular they're talking to, and she's a real person. They're asking her about her life, and she gives some stories of her life and relating what she thinks might be her best moment. Right. And there's a few other people too. And it's just wonderful hearing people talk about even sometimes just the smallest little thing that brought them joy. And that is just one of the things that sticks with them and they want to kind of relive.
It is a lovely film. I can totally see it. It would make a total wonderful double feature with this movie. And people have not seen Afterlife, please seek it out. As I said, there is a really lovely Criterion edition of it now. It shows up on Criterion Channel now and then. You said you had two, the other one being Japanese as well. What else you got?
Got to go with Ozu. At the end of Perfect Days, he actually thanks, Tarkovsky, Truffaut, and Ozu. Obviously, mm-hmm. big relevant influences in his life. Late Spring is one of his. He's got a ton. I've only seen, I think, four of them. I've got to catch up on a bunch. Again, maybe not a perfect analogy, but here's this young woman who just wants to lead a really simple life. She wants to take care of her dad. She wants to go for her bike rides where she gets immense amounts of joy. She's smiling kind of all the time. And people don't want to let her do that because that's not what you should be doing. You need to get married. You must get married. And plots are put in place to get her to marry. And then the plot sort of goes from there. But it's a beautiful look at somebody's view of what the simple life can bring them and why they just want to live this kind of life and how much joy it brings them. And counter to people who think, that's not the right way to live your life. And I think that might be an interesting kind of side note. And just being Ozu too, I think that fits in.
One that came up for me when I was thinking about a movie where we spend long times watching simple acts and there is stakes is a film that has got a lot of attention recently and, gotten a lot of people kind of up in their druthers, but I think a lot of those people haven't given this film its due attention. And I believe it's a movie that we have mentioned on this podcast before, if not, shame on me. But I thought about Jean Dillman, 23 Quai de Commerce, 1080 Brussels, the landmark movie. It was, named the best film of all time on the last Sight and Sound poll, Chantal Ackerman, 1976. It's a film where we spend long amounts of time peel her potatoes or, do her little, make her cutlets. We spend long stretches of time watching Jean go through her day. And it just seems to all be so simple, so workaday, so middle class, so very predictable. And then in the end, something truly shocking happens. I did not expect.
There's your stakes right there. There's your change. Yes. There's your big thing.
Yeah. That is not what I thought Perfect Days was going to be. I wasn't coming along through Perfect Days and thinking the end of Jean Dillman is coming because I really hope it doesn't, because that would have been very out of character for a lot of things. But that is a movie where, you can almost get lulled into complacency of what this film is trying to do and how it's just trying to take you through making a bed, doing your laundry, preparing the food, working your job, working your other job because your main job doesn't pay you money. And oh yeah, by the way, in amongst all of this, something really terrible is going to happen. Mild spoilers for Jean Dillman, if you haven't seen it in the 46 years it's been out, 47 years it's been out. But that's a film I think would make a good double feature. That film is long. That film is like almost 3 hours, I think, if it's not 3 hours exactly. Perfect Days is actually rather brisk for what it wants to do. Jean Dillman is a little more methodical. There are moments in Jean Dillman where if somebody said this feels slow, I'd be like, you're not wrong. That's by design, but you're not wrong. Anyway, I think that those two movies could work well together. I'd probably show Dillman first and then show this as kind of dessert. And I think since you mentioned it earlier, I'll be the one to say that, you know, if somebody wanted to do a Wim Wenders double feature, you could do far worse than watching Perfect Days and following it with Wings of Desire. If people have never seen Wings of Desire, if you happen to have seen City of Angels, well, you've seen the watered down version of Wings of Desire. You know, primarily black and white movie. You're seeing a Berlin that now no longer exists, is the point. Really charming performance by Peter Falk as the fallen angel. A really wonderful performance by the lead actor, whose name is I do not recall, but
Bruno Gans. Just a, Bruno Gans.
Thank you. Has the most expressive face. there's circuses. There's music. There's Nick Cave. There's everything you could ever want in a movie. Fun fact for people: it was my second date with my wife at the Paradise Theater in Toronto. She was too nervous to wear her glasses, so she did not understand a damn thing. Because it's a movie in German. And to be clear, Lindsay does not speak German. So, you know, it's a wonderful movie. And I think it is a nice match with Perfect Days. It's colder, not quite, you know, it's kind of this middle ground. It's not quite as cold as Jean Dielman. It's very, very romantic. You know, it does have the romance of Perfect Days, but on a kind of a grander scale, because we're talking about angels. So we're talking about, you know, heaven and earth, and how they also take delights in small things. They got this thing called smoking and this thing called coffee. And when you do it together, it's fantastic.
And if you're not sure, yes, Peter Falk is the one who actually says that line. There is no doubt about that.
Absolutely. Well, there we go. That is episode 323 of the Matinee Cast. I am so, so very thankful that Bob was able to come by and keep the momentum going. Come on back on Monday, March 25th for episode 324. I'm really excited. We are going to be talking about Love Lies Bleeding. Can't wait to talk about that movie. Yeah, exactly. Bob, if people want to follow you, I guess is Letterboxd the best place to follow you these days?
I'm on there, but I don't do much there. The Logical Mind is my Twitter. So sure, maybe I'll tweet one of these days. I'll use it during TIFF, because I do like sort of and enjoy the back and forth of the immediacy of what people are feeling. I haven't really felt the need to be there much of late.
If you want to get in touch with Bob, just get in touch with me and I will find you.
There you go.
My site is thematinee.ca. For more audio content, you can find back episodes by going to thematinee.ca. You can also find episodes in the usual places: Apple, Google, Spotify, Pocket Cast, you name it. My show is there. Everything gives you handy ways to subscribe for free and get alerts when new episodes drop. Feedback on Perfect Days can be left in the comment section of the site. You can email me, ryan@thematinee.ca. On Twitter, I'm still there, matinee_ca. And there is always Facebook, facebook.com/darkmatinee. Any final thoughts, Mr. Turnbull?
Thank you for the ask. I'm so glad that you kind of pushed me to watch this again. I was going to eventually. So glad I did it.
Thank you for the join. Well. And, you know, I want to like rip a shirt or something so I can like go use that sewing room and actually mend it surrounded by bobbins of thread.
You have a wide choice of colors, as you can see.
Oh my God. I would be there for days.
Not familiar with any of them, but come on up.
Sounds great. For Bob, I'm Ryan. We'll see you at the matinee.